Welcome back to Shadows from the Tree, the podcast where we delve into the darker side of genealogy by exploring stories pulled from newspaper archives and using historical records to find the truth behind them. Specifically, this episode focuses on a shadow from our own family tree and the impact it had on those of lives of those involved. Join us as we shed light on the often overlooked stories and gain a deeper understanding of the challenges those involved faced. So, Michelle, this is 10.3, which we are calling Gunshots and Gravestones.
Yep.
And this is our last recap of the story we've been researching for how many months now?
I feel like it's been years.
Looking at our notes.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's been a long time, so we're, you know, it's bittersweet to wrap this story up. And if you haven't done so already, I definitely recommend listening to the last two episodes, because that will give insight to our family and also the event that took place. So I'm going to get started. And if you're listening, or if you have listened to the past episode, I just wanted to make a quick edit note. So me and Michelle, this is how it goes. It's like, when can you record? Oh, yep. Okay, perfect. Yeah. And then we just get our stuff and we go. Like, there's no... We were so busy with our families and working that we don't even edit our podcast. So what you're listening to is what you get. But we did pause it momentarily last episode to just swap the mic. And I just want to make sure we got this clear, because it's an important part of the story, that on March 13th, 1878, William harnesses his horse to the wagon and goes to Green Island, Warwick, to dig some clams. And then we had estimated that it took 6 hours by horse. But wanted to make sure that was clear. I think one word might have gotten cut off, but it's the start of the story. So wanted to note that. And then when we left off last, we had talked about how the village was going to be thrown into excitement because this was the first murder on record in the town. And the news was going to spread like wildfire, and it did. So we saw that by researching after, you know, we found the first article. We just kept on researching, and we found that this did hit a couple other states like Ohio, Missouri, Massachusetts, Vermont. And I'm going to read that because they all were very short. So it was said at Foster, Rhode Island on the night of the 20th, which we know is the 21st, so there was some confusion there. William Ide returned home drunk and badly beat his wife, who had also been drinking. After the husband fell asleep, the wife took a double-barreled shotgun and killed him. Such are fruits of strong drink. So, and again, newspapers. It wasn't his wife, technically. So a couple details there, but it was definitely being spread all over the U.S. But we did find a newspaper article that had made its way all the way to Sydney, Australia, which was in the Australian Town and Country Journal on May 25th, 1878. So it did take a little while to get there because it happened at the end of March. But I would have loved to just have seen the telephone track record on that, of like who told who to who to get all the way to Australia. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to just read that quickly, because it is really a nice recap of the situation. So it was titled, A Woman's Vengeance. So Providence, Rhode Island, March 22nd, again the date, 1878. Further particulars of the homicide at Hopkins Mill Foster show that William Ide was a hardened, brutal man who had lived with Miss Jeannie Putnam as a paramour for 10 years. She had borne him 2 children. Miss Putnam was married when 13 years of age and is now perhaps 25. On Wednesday evening, I'd return home inflamed by rum and jealousy, and in a prolonged quarrel threatened to kill Miss Putnam. His brother, who lived with them, interfered, and the woman attempted to escape to a neighbor's house. I'd pursued and dragged her back through a rocky field by the hair, causing terrible injuries to her person. At 3 o'clock the next morning, Miss Putnam dragged herself to the room where I'd was sleeping, took down from the hooks a double-barreled shotgun, which was kept loaded for foxes, placed the muzzle to his head, and fired. So, yep, that's exactly what happened in a nutshell. And it just, again, it's just terrible, a terrible time for Jeanette. So It's made its way everywhere in the article. And when we first found this article, like, we only had this one bit of information. I hadn't done a lot of research on this side of my family because I had focused on my, like, paternal side of my dad's family. So I was shocked, absolutely shocked. And the first thing I think I wanted to know was what happened to Jeanette.
Right.
Like, did she get in trouble for this? Did she have to go to jail? Did she not make it because she was injured so badly, you know, with the way medicine and stuff worked back then? So before we get to find out what happened to her, you know, long term, we do have some parts of the timeline that I think are important to call out regarding to just what ended up happening that rest of the day. So going back to Thursday, March 21st, 1878 at 8 a.m., so coroner Herbert Potter impaneled a jury of inquest consisting of Peleg Angel, who was the foreman, Cyrus Arnold, Stephen Tucker, Alfred Hopkins, Pardon Williams, and James Hopkins. And the inquest was held at the house of the murder. After listening to the testimony of the brother and the other witnesses, the coroner spoke to Miss Putnam, who was confined to her bed in considerable pain. Laying beside her was her daughter, Laura, who was 8, who had been attacked with sickness a few days earlier. Her left eye was badly swollen, and black and blue bruises were noticeable on the left side of her face. And it was said that she quoted, "She had always been abused and had made up her mind that she wasn't going to be abused anymore," which is the end of the quote. She pointed the gun and said, again, I quote, "I shot him with the gun, firing the left-hand barrel," end quote. So a juryman then examined the weapon and found that the barrel was empty while the right-hand barrel was still loaded. So it sounds like she was truthful in telling that.
There was no hiding from what happened.
And then at 12 p.m., so at noontime, the jury had 4 hours of a hearing, and they returned the verdict that the deceased came to his death by a gunshot wound in the head from a gun in the hands of Jeanette Putnam. I mean, all the evidence, again, was there, and she's not denying
forward.
It.
Yeah.
Yep. Coroner Potter made known the result of the inquest to trial justice George Tinglinghast. Is that how you would say that, Michelle?
Tinglinghast.
It's an interesting one. And a warrant was issued charging Jeanette Putnam with the murder of William Ide. She was arraigned Thursday afternoon, pled guilty, and was ordered to be committed without bail to the Providence County Jail to await the action of the grand jury. So, what do you think she's thinking at this point?
She's like, at least I'm not going to be beat every day, maybe. And
yeah. And I think, too, like, what's going to happen? She's probably thinking, if I go to jail, what's going to happen to the kids?
Yeah, her daughter. She's probably more worried about her daughter's well-being. And then I was thinking, when she did this, was she not only protecting herself, but her children, right?
Exactly.
Because she had already taken matters and jumping out a window, holding that, like, so she was in desperate measures at that point in her life.
Yep, I agree. So they were going to take her off to jail to await the grand jury, but because she was unable to leave her bed, Dr. Arnold went over to give her a careful examination of her condition, and according to town surgeon Alvin Shippey, who saw in Matthew Rounds, she was placed in his custody at the house. Okay. So I guess someone was watching them.
Yeah.
Constable Shippey came to the city with a certificate signed by Dr. Arnold, referring to her low condition and her inability to move for the present. And in the absence of Attorney General Sales, Assistant Attorney General Hopkins consented to her remaining at the house until she could be brought to the city.
Yeah. From what we had read, it seemed like the town was on her side.
All for her. Yeah.
They knew what kind of a man he was, and they agreed with her actions, I think.
Yep. So then, again, you know, the constable, Albert Shippey, wanted to arrest her and bring her to the city. But again, the doctors counseling otherwise. They brought in another doctor who said she is suffering frightfully, her head and face being terribly bruised, and internal injuries preventing any movement of the body. Saying she's in a critical state. She says in another article, so a separate article, that she can't remember the killing, but knows she got the gun and fell on the floor when it went off. So I think, I mean, I'm sure she went into shock doing that.
Right, quite a traumatic experience and recall of the events. Right. Who knows?
And the article said the probabilities are that she was temporarily insane from fear and suffering when she did the deed, as it was written.
Yeah.
And then you have the town, right? So then you have one of the neighbors who was quoted to say, "We can sleep now without fear of being murdered, you know, on our own property." So they were also relieved.
Yeah.
And the one part of the article that I read, which I will just tell you the title because I thought it was really interesting. So the headline for this article was, "The Foster Murder, A Woman's Desperation, Beaten Near to Death, Her Awful Retaliation, A Sleeping Man Sent into Eternity, Frightful Social Conditions, Living for Years in Sin, An Awful Story of Crime." So the person who wrote this article had actually gone to the house to get the information. And at the end of the article, it says, you know, "The miserable, furnished, old gray house on the side hill, frowning out from the rocks and dead grass, made one shiver as he left the place and looking back to wonder at the civilization that could permit such a condition of things to exist so long and accumulate in so horrible a crime in our own little state." So that was from the reporter. And again, sympathy for the women, driven to the deed, and everyone was just horrified with the whole situation, but again, happy. It also says, sympathy for the women driven to the deed, a shudder at the sudden taking off of the man in the midst of his sin. Horror and circumstances of the crime were the feelings of the reporter as he turned his horse's head homeward and left the crime-stained house in Foster. I just think about the horse galloping on the road to go write this newspaper article back then. And then it even was said that it would be very difficult to select a jury from the town of Foster who would be unbiased on the matter. Again, to your point. Well,
they knew his character and they knew hers and
And then actually one of the, I forget what the name of it is, but you know those, all those books about like your state, Burrville, Rhode Island, Pawtucket, East Providence. Yeah, they have the history books. There was a picture of a Dr. Henry Arnold, and I was confused if this would have been him, or I know his dad was also a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a nice picture of him and his wife, which just gives some more context. But so I remember, before we get into it, I remember the moment that I found the outcome in the paper, and I was just like, I must have stayed up late researching or something. Yeah. I just remember being like, Michelle, I found it. So we're going to get into that coming up now. So Tuesday, April 2nd, 1878. So she's been staying in the house while she can't move, things like that. So in the morning, town surgeon Shippey and Constable Potter visited the shanty where Jeanette was still confined to her bed. And then on April 4th, 1878, the Providence Evening Press wrote that Jeanette was released on a bail, so for $5,000 from the state prison where she was assigned comforting quarters in the female department. So between the end of May and April, she was well enough then to go to the prison. But they put her in good, comfortable spots. She gets $5,000 bond, who was from, paid by Charles Harris, John Ripple, George Davis, and Joseph Gehan.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you did the math that would have been like $30,000 today.
Right. With inflation and, the difference. So that's not a small sum. So they must have really supported, like, they could have just left this poor girl and, just said, well, you did what you did, but everyone felt for her, and to such an extent, they're going to pay
that much money. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And we had this written down as, like, something we wanted to research and keep, like, these people, because we wanted to know, why were they of such importance to her that they would pay that much? And one being George Davis, her mother's side of the family's name.
Right, Davis.
You know, something we never got to, but I'm assuming they would have had to.
Some kind of relation, family.
Yep. So, she had a small stint at the jail in the female department before the bond was paid. And then here it comes. The deed justified was how it was titled in the Minnesota paper from June 13, 1878. So we have gone, you know, a good couple of weeks between the incident happened. The grand jury of the Common Pleas Court refused to indict a woman of murdering her husband in the terrible domestic tragedy and found no bill in the case of Miss Jeanette Putnam. I feel like this is like an applauding moment. Right? Like, that's great. That's, I would have been horrified if it had gone the other way.
Right.
Just horrified. And, you know, she had been the recipient of expression again from not only the residents, but the jury found, you know, the grand jury found nothing wrong with that.
I think the articles, too, did, like, do her justice as well. Like, they didn't just say, oh, she shot his,
shot
his head off. You know, they gave her story, which doesn't happen a lot. Like, you don't hear women's side of the stories a lot.
That is so true, especially in 1878. And to your point, had we not known all those facts, she was married at 13.
Right.
Her dad died in the war. Like, maybe you wouldn't have had as much sympathy for her.
Right.
You wouldn't have gotten a feeling of how did the neighbors relate to her or, you know. So, that was great. I found that and I was just like, finally. Because it took a while to find that. I remember just taking a long time to find that. And there was about 4 or 5 articles that I found that talked about, just very short, talked about her being not guilty.
Yeah.
So that's just great.
They even called her the heroine, I think, right?
Oh, yeah, the heroine of the Hopkins Mill tragedy, discharged.
Yeah, I liked that one.
Well, yeah. So that's what we were waiting for. And then comes more questions, right? So we find all the research for the whole story. And then it's like, well, you want to keep knowing more, right? That's the problem when you get into doing genealogy. You can't help but want to keep finding more and more answers.
Yeah. So then her life didn't end there.
Right.
Like, that was just a part of her life. So where does she go after that?
What happened to her children? What happened to the land? Like, all these questions. So we continued, right? We kept doing more and more research. Oh,
the rabbit hole got just deeper and deeper.
So true. So, the one thing that, you know, I think is a great fact-checking record was me and my aunt, who was, like, our family historian, we went to the town hall and found the actual death record for William Ide. So, they specifically date the death March 21st, 1878. He was 50 years old, 9 months and 27 days. The place of death was Foster. It does list him as a widower, which again confirms that they never got married.
Right.
And he's claiming he's still a widow. Yeah. And it listed his occupation as a carpenter, birth in Foster, the name of the parents, Oliver H. and Penelope Ide. And then the disease or cause of death, Michelle?
Murdered.
Yes. Murdered. So,
not consumption, which is like the norm.
I know. So, that just really ticked a huge box in the whole story that's how it was recorded.
Because when you look at those records, you don't see murdered.
No, you definitely don't. And so, I guess the first person, Michelle, I don't know, we should maybe talk about quick just is George.
Yeah.
George Ide. So, obviously, he split the land with his brother, William. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, one of the article, there was a couple of records we found in the town hall, and I will say I'm not a very strong record land person. I don't read them well, and I need to
it's
do...
very legal.
Yes. And the handwriting in it, it's hard, but... Yeah. In April 7th, 1879, the town hall record we found for George W. Ide said that he was the highest bidder in an auction of the estate of William Ide with a sum paid of $10. Which is confusing because then, like, that's really not, I mean, not a lot of money if someone wanted to outbid him. I'm sure there's more people with more money than that. I don't know. So I guess he got then the full set of land that was belonging to his father, Oliver.
Right.
And then there was another record that went into, like, where the mortgage was the sale of a farm, and that was April 17, 1879. So it's undetermined. I mean, all the documents are here, but to me, it's undetermined if he got the full set of land and continued to live there. And because he passed away in December 23, 1898, the next census would have been the 1900 census, which, right. You know, so we can't see where he was living, and he was at the age of 79. So I don't know if he kept the land. Maybe he couldn't pay it, living, you know, being there by himself. So it's a little undetermined, and there are ways you can get land records at the town hall, but again, not my strong suit. So, and then on his gravestone, he's also buried at the Hopkins Ide Cemetery in Foster, it says, "Jesus is my friend." And then, you know, 79 is pretty old to live in, you know, the 1900s. He had lived for 20 more years after his wife had, 20 years after the event. So, you know, he carried that whole story with him for that long. Mm-hmm. And then his wife died in 1892. He had some children who didn't make it, you know, in his lifetime. And a sad point I found was that three of his children passed away in 1852, probably consumption.
Yeah.
You know, he had Mary 6, Penelope 4, and Amanda 1. And then he did have a couple older children who did live on past him, one being Lilith Ide Barber, who we found. So that's George. And I guess one remaining question, I don't know if it's a question, but a theory. I don't know. I said this when I first read the story. Could George, I don't know. What if George was the one to do it? Do you think that could have been plausible? Like,
she
couldn't even move.
Right.
And he had heard them bickering. He tried to stop them. He seemed like a character who was empathetic, but
he'd already broken them apart once.
Right. But he didn't maybe want to stand up to his younger brother. Like, maybe he was afraid of him to fully.
Yeah.
I don't know. So I feel like, I don't know. It's always a little theory in my head. Like, could he have been the one to just do it?
It's plausible.
I don't know.
It's plausible.
But that's George. And then a cool thing to tie it to now. I've been speaking to someone who is a descendant of George W. Ide. George would have been his third great-grandfather. He's on a mission to find out if he is the only one of the Oliver and Penelope Ide family to carry on the Ide name, which I think is a cool thing to try to find out. And I think he might be right, because a lot of the people I found, the siblings and their kids and their kids, and all died sort of young.
Yeah.
So, hopefully, yeah, it'll be interesting if you can get a final answer on that. And so then I'm going to, so that's George. Before we get into the kids, I just wanted to turn it over to Michelle, because she found quite an interesting record from the probate of Foster in April 17th, 1878. So.
Right. So this is less than a month, right? Than the murder. So they're going through, they do an inventory of all of the William Ide household. So there is literally three pages and lists, like, everything that this man owned, basically.
From a shovel.
Shovel to a hound dog and a horse and barrels and potatoes. I think there was like bushels of potatoes still. And then on the very last page, on like nearly the second to last line, it says one double-barreled shotgun. and it is worth $10, which is like the crazy. Second highest worth on his possessions. The other one was the hound dog, was what, $25 for the hound dog. So that was quite the find to see that it was still in
the house.
Like, it wasn't like now where they take
all the evidence.
It's just like he could have bought the murder weapon. Yeah. Like, that's just crazy.
And the one thing that you said wasn't on here,
right,
was the portrait of himself. Portrait,
yeah. So who took that? Where'd it go?
Yeah.
Was it not considered worth anything? Right. Like, they didn't even inventory it.
And then in this, I don't know if you had seen it, but I was digging through this document or this record as well. There was like a couple other pages like later on that were mentioning his name.
Yeah.
So I don't know if after they appraised these, if he owed people money.
Yeah.
Who sold them? Like, who would have sold these items, do you think?
It was whoever he owed money would get whatever it
just
was
the worth. Items, you think, or the money?
No, I think they would sell it at like an auction. Oh. And then they would get the remains. Because I think it was like, oh, this person was owed $3 to William, and this person was owed, like, it was really, it seemed like penny, like,
yeah,
really petty that they were right. all getting like $4 or $5 from this man's
interesting like estate.
Yeah.
And then whatever was left over, did it get offered to his children? I mean, that's
or
the
George
thing,
didn't George right. get the land after?
True. Like, did they just get
did
left
he just
there?
Get the leftovers?
But I think finding this was really cool because we then from the newspaper articles have an idea of what the outside and the building looked right. like, and then to know like what contents were living in the house back then.
It was even a snare drum. I was like,
oh, did you see? I didn't see a snare drum.
I saw a snare drum. I was like, who's playing the snare drum? Like, were the kids like into
wow.
that? And I knew you were a drummer, so
yeah.
I was like, that's, cool. that's weird.
That's really cool. I know. I need to look through this more in depth because
yeah, it listed a lot of different things that were in the house. And,
yeah,
you know,
really
you get a picture of, you know, it had the bed and the bedstand and a bureau and, you know,
yeah.
so you could kind of see what was there. But everything they mentioned in the article says it was in, like, a dilapidated
yeah.
state. Like, the house wasn't in...
Not great.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was really, really cool. What do you think we should do next? The children or Jeanette?
Let's do Jeanette.
All right. So I'll leave that to you because I think you found most of her stuff.
Okay. All right. So I think it's important to talk about Jeanette's children, Laura
mm-hmm.
and William F. Ide. So we're under the assumption, after looking at dates and records, that Laura is actually William's child
yeah.
because Putnam was like out of the picture.
Long gone.
Yeah. And she had already been living with the Ide family for
yep,
years.
Since
so
yep.
yeah, so she was definitely his daughter, even though he never seemed to claim her. Like, it was always Laura
yep,
Putnam, Laura Davis. So you did find her gravestone.
Yeah.
And what did it say on there? I thought
oh my
that was
gosh.
Really special.
So it said little Laura.
Yeah.
And it was just this little white old stone that gave like the death, her birthday and her death date. And it was
yeah.
just, it was really humbling.
Yeah. Like, heartbreaking. Yeah.
And that was only just recent that
yeah,
this
we
went there.
Could.
Yes.
Yeah.
And one last ditch effort to find
yeah.
stuff.
So,
but you had found the birth certificate, the death certificate.
Right. And that was, she had died at 8 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So
yep.
it was in the midst of all of this.
Yeah,
so,
April 27, 1878. So
yeah, that's this like a month after.
And if I go back, she would have been on, Jeanette would have been on bail, but she wouldn't have known her fate yet.
Yeah.
So she's dealing with the death of her daughter.
I'm wondering if that was one of the reasons that
True.
People helped her out because they knew.
Or she just
like,
lost.
Like, her daughter was sick and.
That's a good point.
Wasn't able to be there for her.
Mm-hmm.
And, yep, so she ended up passing from consumption. So, again, it's just the main cause of death back then, it seems like.
Mm-hmm.
So, a couple years later, we're in 1880, we found on a census that Jeanette was working at a woolen mill in Killingly, and she was boarding there as well. So, you know, they had the mill, and then there was housing
mm-hmm.
right next to it, and... there's also a boarder listed named Everett Carpenter. And that is important because the following year in 1881, it was April 24th. So April again,
Jesus.
3 years later, she's getting married to this Everett Carpenter. I know. So we are assuming they were like three lines apart on the border list on that census. So they must have met working at the mill in Killingly.
And what was their age difference?
Yeah, she was older by 3 or 4 years. So
wasn't anything wild with William. Yeah, yeah. Good for her. This is what she should have had all along.
Yeah, it seems like this Everett was a nice man. They didn't have any children. Mm-hmm. They lived in a couple areas. So we found, I looked up the house they lived in Warwick.
That's
cool. It's this cute little, looks like a little cape house. In the 30s, they lived there. But on Everett's death record, we had just looked at that. And the person who was informed of it and who was going to be responsible for the burial and stuff was actually William F. Ide. So, you know.
Laura's child.
Yeah, listed as stepson. So they must have stayed close and, she didn't abandon her son.
That's great.
Yeah.
It's really humbling to know that she continued a relationship with him.
Right. So we have a lot of pictures where we don't know necessarily names on these faces, but they're from the time period, and we really, you know, we really were hoping to narrow that down, but it's hard when you don't know the faces.
Right. You at least know one. You need to know one to be able to connect at least a time period for sure.
Yep. Definitely.
I'm just so glad that she found Everett and moved on. And I think, to your point, we already talked about Laura, but the other children, I think it's somewhat sad because in 1880, they're all dispersed.
Right.
So she's trying to probably make money.
Yep.
To provide for them.
Right.
And.
Or even herself at that point.
Exactly. Yeah. So we have Laura, who's since passed, William Franklin Ide, who you said was living with
the Harris family.
The Harris family. So we don't.
Killingly, yeah. It was Asa and his wife, and they were older. They were in their 70s, and he's listed as a 7 or 8 year old. So it's hard to know. Is he someone's grandparent? Is he a great aunt or uncle on the Davis side?
Because it's in Killingly where she was born. So
it's probably some older relation that's helping her.
Or, at that point, I'm just making the connection now as we speak, she's working in Killingly. So maybe even though he was living with somebody else that same year.
She was supporting and she couldn't have him board with her in the mill housing.
Yeah. Right?
Because she probably had a one bed, not even her own room. You know, like those situations
exactly.
where they would pile people in.
So I would like to think that in 1880 they still were having a mother-son relationship.
Right.
Then we have James Allen Ide, who's my second great-grandfather. He had then since been moved out of the house during this whole event, and he just was trying to be an employer, same thing, kind of boarding and just trying to, I'm sure, get some money for himself. And then Mary Nellie Ide in 1880 was living with her cousin, and she was listed as specifically cousin, Lillis Ide Barber. So she had gotten married, Lillis, to Arthur Barber, and they were living in his family's household. Mm-hmm. And then she was living there. So I had two thoughts on that. One, I was like, hopefully she knows this Barber family as a little girl, that she's comfortable with them. Or maybe she only really knows Lillis, and hopefully she took on a kind of motherly role at that point in time. So.
Yep.
And then Emily Ide, I could not find her in 1880 listed, so that's an open task to do.
But she did live a long time. Yeah. Able to find a marriage record to that Byron Angel, but they did end up divorced, so she's not buried with him. He has this big headstone in Providence with his parents and siblings and has his name on it, but it didn't. We had to look at the actual, footnote on the gravestone, and it said divorced Emily Ide. So we had to figure out where she ended up. The there's no indexing for the death records for those years, so we're gonna have to dig a little deeper on that one.
Yep. So, but it's good to know she lives into old age. We have Mary Nellie Ide, who also lives into old age, which is great, having, you know, children and things like that. And then William Franklin Ide as well lives until 1933. Mm-hmm. So, you know, seeing as they lost so many of their potential siblings, cousins during, you know, that time frame, it's nice to know that they all, besides Laura, lived a long life. And then we have my second great-grandfather, James Allen Ide, who lived a long life. It was kind of said in my family that, like, I always heard mention of, like, the Ide farm. So I think they left that sort of good impression of having a nice place for the family to go and see distant relatives. And I'm just going to quickly read his obituary that I have just to give a sense of who he was. So James Allen Ide, 75. He was a road commissioner for the town of Burrville from 1895 to 1915. He says he died last evening shortly before 6 o'clock at the farm on North Road, Bridgeton. He suffered a frozen right foot about 5 years ago and an amputation was necessary. Since then, he's been in failing health, and he was a resident of Burrville for about 55 years. Previous to serving as road commissioner under both the Democratic and Republican parties in Burrville, Mr. Ide was a lumberman, and he operated a sawmill in the Burrville Forest. After he gave up town work, he engaged in farming. He was prominent in different circles, was a member of a Granite Lodge, Lodge number 56, and he was a Shriner, which was interesting to learn about him, and it does confirm he was born July 4th, 1863 at Gloucester, a son of William, and it mentions Emily Green, but that's Mary Green, and he was educated in the Gloucester Public Schools. He leaves his wife, who was Sarah Jane Moore, and two daughters and a son. So, and some grandchildren. So he lived a very, you know, a very nice, probably comfortable life.
Yeah, the cycle stopped with him. Yeah.
Which I think is huge to, you know, we can't really say that, to a sense, you know, the daughters and of William, but specifically my great-grandfather, who, again, was the only one to probably escape the situation.
He left earlier, being the oldest. Yeah, he knew what was...
Yep.
It was not a good place to be.
Yep.
He removed himself.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's the children. And I think... I guess we can jump to the cemetery. So, Michelle... Let me just put this on the record. So, Michelle sent me, I guess a long time ago, the headstone and grave information for Jeanette in Everett.
Yeah.
And I must have just overlooked it, because I feel like if I would have known, I would have been like, let's go, you know? So just this week, I decided to go because I thought I found new information. So I decided to go, and that's when we find the grave of Laura, because originally I saw Laura Carpenter listed on Find a Grave the same date. So I was like, that's just a coincidence. Like, you know, so I called the cemetery, which I always recommend because I feel like they can pull certain cards and get information. Her card was blank. But after going to the cemetery, and luckily the lawn keeper helped me because I was given some directions, like left at the tree, you know. Yeah. So we found the area. I thought we couldn't find it. And in one last effort, I kind of looked a little more, and there it was. And to my surprise, it was like a humbling moment, because you have Laura, little Laura, next to her, like very close. Like, these are not spread out. Next to her is Jeanette and Everett. Next to her is William F. Ide, her son, Jeanette's son. Right. And then above William is his son. And then kind of like the row behind where Jeanette's gravestone is her mom and her brother and her sister.
Yeah.
So that moment for me, because I'd always wondered, like, poor Jeanette went through this horrible thing. Did she ever connect with her family again? Did she? And this moment made me feel like she did. Like, seeing them all so close, even though they're dead, you know.
Yeah.
It just was a moment of, like, they must have carried on some type of healthy relationship.
Right.
And especially after we just found that record with Everett saying that his stepson,
yep,
he probably was the father figure for him.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really cool, and yeah, I'm really glad.
Abandon her. She didn't abandon her kids. Like,
right.
She stayed close to them, even right, when she couldn't live with them. It seems like they still had relationships.
Right. So I'm really that was a humbling moment, and I'm glad I did that before we recorded this episode. And so I don't know if you want to speak a little bit to just I got a couple quotes from our family about...
Let's talk about the other graveyard first.
Oh, yes. Okay. Yes. Good point. Don't want to miss that part.
So it's the Ide family plot on the Tucker Hollow
Road. Yes.
So it's a dirt road, everybody. It's still a dirt road. It'll probably always be a dirt road.
And I hope it does. Yeah.
It's pretty long. I'd say it's at least a mile, right?
Yeah,
it
seemed to be. Yeah.
And we're driving down very slow. And we're looking, this was last summer.
Yeah.
Last fall. And we find the marker for the telephone pole with the number. We have to go through high grass. And what do we hear in the background, Danielle?
It was wild. There were gunshots.
Like, there's a gun club, like, further across on the...
Right next to it. And I read this in, like, I found, when I was trying to find out how we get to this cemetery site, because it's off the beaten path, someone had said about there being a gun club. So I brought my aunt some.
The Blaze Orange.
The Blaze Orange, a nice bright thing, because I was like, I'm not going in and unprotected here.
Yeah.
But
like the echo of the gun, though.
The whole time. Yeah. It wasn't even like...
No, it just kept going.
They just were shooting at whatever like over there.
Either target practice, probably. But it was
But so
surreal.
While we're walking around looking at the graves of George Ide, Oliver, Penelope, Almond, Leonard.
Yeah. They were all together. And who was missing?
William.
And there's an... We have pictures of it. There's an empty area. There's Penelope, and there's Almond, and there's an empty spot right in the middle. No headstone. And we're like, he's got to be here.
He's got to. Because one article I found had said something about on the 21st, he was being... I don't know if it said... a funeral or buried. I can't remember the word.
Yeah.
So to have a turnaround time like that, he had to be very close.
Right. It was across the way. So we get back in our car. We drive like, what, 100 yards?
Yeah, we're just driving
and
along.
There's a house. That's the Tucker, Stephen Tucker's house. Yeah. Is right on the water, which is where you can picture her running down this hill. There's trees and...
We're reading the story. Yeah. We're just like...
Yeah, we reread it in front of...
And I had goosebumps.
Yeah. It was hearing gunshots, seeing where it happened, standing where it happened. It was surreal. It went, like, deeper for me. I don't know for you.
Oh, yeah.
It made it hit harder that...
I actually have the goosebumps thinking about it, because...
How real it really was. Like, being there, you could sense it in a way.
And I think the extra tie, you know, I'm all for stories like this.
Yeah.
You know, obviously we've created whole podcasts about stories and with these, like, situations, but to know that this person was my, ancestor.
Yeah.
Even though Jeanette wasn't a blood relative, I mean, there's blood through my great-uncle William, you know, the great, but it really is hit home.
Yeah. It's a different kind of connection to this story.
It really was.
I remember getting handed the paper your aunt had typed out the article, because it was hard to read in the print form. So she typed it out, and I remember reading it, and I sat there, because it's long, and I sat there for a half an hour, and I'm like, this is unbelievable. And like, what happened to her? What happened? So we had to know.
We had to know. And I think, you know, from... I got my cousin, who's my first cousin, she said specifically the details shocked her She said, but the ending is what left her speechless of the yeah. first original article that we found.
Yeah.
Because it was a long time before we started collecting these other documents. Like, it took a lot of gathering.
Yep.
And then my aunt, who this would have been her second great-grandfather, she had actually said that she had heard back in 2010 sort of about this situation, but it was told much differently. And then she didn't realize back then how we were connected to the story. And she was told that the eyed relative was shot by his wife outside and neighbors propped him up against a tree so it would look like he got shot by a hunter. And then she also heard that they said she shot him because he was a mean old cuss. So,
yeah, I mean, he was, so.
Yeah, so the folklore of it, too, because I feel like there was some point, too, where someone said they heard he was buried under an apple tree. Yeah,
I actually had heard about the apple tree thing.
Yeah, so, yeah. And maybe I had, I don't know if someone ever told me this story prior, and I never stuck in my brain, but honestly, all the things that we've found recently, I just heard about since this past, this past summer, right? And so... It just kind of ties me back to when we went to go visit, and I, again, am always cautious and respective of people's property yeah. there, so we were respective of that.
Yeah, we didn't go on the
property. Yeah, and
we
I would not
the street.
And, right, yeah. And I don't think that is cool to do that. So, but when we were standing on the road, we had a car drive by. And I think he first pulled over to check we were okay.
Yeah, because we were standing there for a while. We read the story out loud, so... Yeah. They probably have cameras. They were like, who are these people standing?
So the guy drives by in his truck. I think it was a black truck, if I remember.
Yeah.
And I had his name at some point. But he belonged to the gun club.
Yep.
And he made sure we were okay, which was really nice. And he's trying to talk. And I think he said, it's like, excuse me a second. And he had something in his mouth. And he had been sucking on a lifesaver. And he actually even offered us the lifesaver. And that... was just a moment for me because my grandfather, who is a descendant of the Ides,
yeah.
he always had lifesavers on him, and there was a lot of grandkids, so he would break the lifesaver in half to give it to more people, and we would call them twos. So we'd always say, Grandpa, can I have a two? And the fact that this guy in the middle of Tucker Hall Road, we don't know him.
He gave you a mint lifesaver.
A lifesaver in connection to my grandfather who was yeah. related as an Ide. It was just, the whole thing was surreal. And yeah. I'm really happy, despite the terrible things that took place in the story and for these people involved,
mm-hmm.
for us to be able to take the time and put the story together is really, really, really humbling. And I think for people who are also... like the person I'm talking with who's an Ide, like it brings light to those people as well.
Right.
And just ties everything together. So, oh, it was a lot. We did a lot. I'm very, very, very proud of us. And I think for, speaking to Tucker Hollow Road, we found an article that Michelle's going to read a quick blurb from that was written in, 1955?
51.
Okay.
Yeah, by George Loveridge. So he had owned that property at one point.
Yeah,
so, Tucker Hollow, in the smallest, most densely populated state in the Union, there's still many spots like this. So it's called a love letter to Tucker Hollow. Here, every season, every hour brings some reminder of those mighty rhythms of creation that cities tend to obscure or to deny. So he goes on, he's just basically saying, how it, the silence sustains his soul, and the area is so beautiful with the water mm-hmm. and the trees, and it's just
it is beautiful,
a serene
yeah.
place. But the last paragraph, really, it just, decades, it's beautiful. So decades before us, there must have been the creaking of wagon wheels on frosty mornings, the stomp of horses in the barn, the thud of an axe, and the chant of sleigh bells on Tucker Hollow Road. And there must have been, many years ago, a man who left the scythe blade rusting in a crevice of the stone wall, meaning, no doubt, to have gone back to it the next day or the day after. Sometimes I wonder who he was or what he looked like and why he didn't go back, whether he forgot or was discharged or took sick or died or whatnot. But no one ever goes back, not really, nor ever can.
Oh, my God.
Right? I got chills.
I got chills.
Thinking about it, Like, in his mind, did he know what had happened? Like, yeah, in the back of his mind, like, did he know that that had happened right there?
That was very beautifully written.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that, so the title, what journal was that from?
It was from Providence Journal. Okay. In 1951.
Yeah. No, that was really, I think that's a great place to conclude it, honestly. Yeah. I just want to say that Michelle, again, very proud of us. Yes, I was reading a stat that according, let me pull it up, according to LinkedIn, 90% of podcasts don't make it past episode 3, and 90% of the remaining 200,000 podcasts quit after 20 episodes. And then from there, only 20% of podcasts that launch in a year make it to the next year. And if there's one thing about me, Michelle, we're goal setters. Yeah. So we already made it past 3 episodes, right? So the next one's, if we finish this, you know, we finish season 1 here, we're going to be set to start season 2. I think we'll roll that out in the fall.
Yeah. We'll take a break for the summer.
Take a break in the summer.
We already have, like, the themes we want to stick with.
Yep.
The stories. We have some outlines already, so.
Yep. So it's going to happen. So, So I think one goal for us is to double our listener count, right?
Yep.
So that's just a personal goal we're setting. So over the summer, we're hoping to amp up some social media, maybe make some connections to some papers, things like that. But we still would love for your help, because I know the way podcasts and things work like that, word social media.
Share.
Yeah, word of mouth. Yep. Share, please. Share things. I think rating the podcast, that's, I heard, is pretty helpful. So if you wouldn't mind doing that, if you've been an active listener, we'd appreciate it. And as always, if you have any stories, even if it's like one little thing you've been told that was crazy that you want
family
us to dig into.
Lore. Family weird lore story.
Yep.
Send it in.
Send it in. So we have shadowsfromthetree@gmail.com or shadowsfromthetree on social media and hopefully Instagram. So that's it.
Yeah,
we did it.
Season one
complete.
We did it. Thanks everyone for listening, following along the journey, and come back.
Yes, please. Thank you.